Record this so people like
you. Do you have any thoughts on like raising your kids religious in Israel specifically?
It's a hard one. It's hard because it's a very quick changing dynamic. Both because the world is changing rapidly. So by the time you have kids, Amir Tashem, even 5 years or 6 years is a whole different culture comp. And Israel is a very, very rapidly because there's so many pressure points in Israel, internally and externally. So it's very, very hard to. And fortunately, I mean, I understand some rabbanim are actually saying today because it's so hard to raise children in Israel. Some rabbanim say stay in America, and I see the logic of that. I also see the logic of saying that part of the price of changing history is that, you know, and your kids are not going to fall off the radar of Judaism. It just won't be for them, which is very hard to handle, but. Now, you don't want to initiate that, but you can't avoid historical responsibility because it may be challenging to your own personal. I would say as follows. I've talked about it before. Religious faith and religious inculcation, religious indoctrination, which is essentially what education is. I'm using harsh words because these are words we normally, we're not dogmatic and we're not propaganda. We are. It's just a question of where you draw the cursor, right? None of us believes in complete cultural encounter. Throw the windows open, everything's in, let our children see everything, and let them make choices. That's suicide. We all believe that there has to be, first of all, filtering, what we want in, what we want out, and filtering takes place at all levels, internal to the family, to the community, to a conversation. And we also want commenting where one of the commenters is in a position of moral authority and intellectual superiority than everyone else, and people expect them to listen. So when you're a parent one day and an issue comes up at the table, your job is not to just say, I'm neutral, say what you'd like, but say, this is what we believe in. Now, obviously, you can't always convince people, and the older people get, the more they get a mind of their own. But sometimes I think people are a little bit too critical of, let's say, Haredim or anyone else that decides to draw red lines. Everyone has to draw a line somewhere. And the question is where you choose to draw the line, how you balance between exposure and insularity. But so much of religion is looking back to the past and accepting the traditions and the authority and the accrued religious experience of the past. It's called Masara. That's called Minhagim. That's called traditions and the authority of Halacha. Now, what's happening in Eretz Yisrael is there's a very, very sharp turn. Look at the future. We're now building the future. We have a new world that's opening up in front of us. And 1948 was a seismic shift in the history of Am Yisrael. And we are discovering new modes of religious expression, right? No one ever thought you could be religious through geography. Like, you're in Poland. There's nothing sacred about that geology or geography. Now, all of a sudden, there are people who get deep religious meaning from Tirlim and knowing the land and studying the land and filling it one with the land. No one ever thought that part of Avodas Hashem is trying to shape your society. You know, we always are like Goyim. We always wanted to advance humanity, but we're always on the margins of society. And now all of a sudden there's a whole new lexicon and a whole new dictionary and a whole new field of Avodas Hashem. And at the least, it's creating what I would say is a log jam. We don't have enough bandwidth. You can have enough bandwidth to process all that and still learn and still perform a mitzvah and still. But existentially, it's not just a question of bandwidth. Existentially, it's a question of you've got two contradictory statements. One is look back to the past. One is look to the future. And its most harshest incarnation, right, a lot of secular Zionists, and I think a lot of that has seeped into religious Zionist thought. The secular Zionists look back at pre-1948 as shameful and embarrassing and empty, and those were weak Jews. And you see this a lot with the whole Warsaw Ghetto uprising. And for a lot of people, when it comes to Yom HaShoah, so they're only capable of processing the Warsaw Ghetto uprising because in their mind space, they can't handle weak Jews, in their mind, weak Jews who were victimized. It's only about the Jews who rose up and defended themselves. The 0.005% if you look at the entire, and I'm not blaming any Jews, I'm just saying, as opposed to taking a look back at exile and putting it into perspective. What does it mean to be in exile? What caused the exile? What was the great miracle of Jewish survival? How did we survive? How did we shape the world? And looking back at that as a source of heritage. And that's why in Chutz Aretz it's very binary. Chutz Aretz has two binary advantages of raising kids. First of all, there's no looking forward in terms of a contrast to looking back. Obviously, we're always looking forward because we're progressing. But that contrast between the two doesn't exist, that almost conflict. Number two, now in Chutz Laaretz, and this is the second part of living in our world, it's very binary because it's very hard to be Jewish in a very deep way unless you're also religious. I mean, it's feasible. People are very, very deeply Jewish and very deeply committed to their Judaism, to the State of Israel, through political activism. But it's certainly not the Yiddishkeit that we live with, we're accustomed to. Whereas here, we're creating a whole phalanx of, and a whole pantheon of values, and we're trying to tell the kids, okay, but this is the supreme value, and it's Taran Yerushalayim, and part of Taran Yerushalayim is the apogee on the pyramid, is Am Yisrael, and part of Am Yisrael is secular Jews who are committed. It's like it's four rows down on the pyramid, and we're expecting to build pyramids. Adults do pyramids very well. Teenagers don't do pyramids very well. Teenagers like this block or that block. I call it the Shimon Peres syndrome. When Shimon Peres died, we all lined up to eulogize him, and for good reason, because he was a Jewish hero. So if you're an adult mind, you say, okay, he represented some of the values that I incorporated in my pyramid very, very devoutedly, very devotedly, very passionately, and therefore I'm going to celebrate him. Or let's say a different a secular soldier dies in battle. We'll go to the Levios and we'll... And in our minds, because he's one part of our entire collage of values, and that person died for one of the values that we believe is very deep. And of course, at a personal level, but teenagers tell themselves, well, oh, I can be a Jewish hero, deeply Jewish, if I am a secular soldier, and a secular, not dying, but a secular soldier who succeeds. So the conversation here has to be much more nuanced and much more sophisticated. Not sophisticated, but yes, I would say sophisticated. You have to have conversations, hard conversations with your kids. We had hard conversations with our kids in which we told them, and we don't exactly live in Las Vegas, we live in Alon Shvot. But we had conversations with our kids about what we don't agree with in Alon Shvot. And it was very hard for our kids to hear. What do you mean, my friends aren't good enough for you? He said, it's not about your friends. Your friends are great. They're welcome in this house. You know, but I'm not sure that I agree with playing ball on Shabbos. And I'm not sure that I agree with some of the codes at Tznius. And then there are codes. And how do you say that without bad-mouthing or blacklisting or defaming people? So I think you have to, when you live with a lot of people, like in America, you tend to live clustered with the people that represent more or less your value system. Here, you're living, whether in your community or not, you're living in more national identities. So that's a communal identity. So the conversations, how do you have a conversation which is critical without being defamatory? And he said, these are not our values, even though we love every Jew, and really, but there's still a difference. How do you create a Big Ten without diluting the value system? So it takes a lot of good communication, as with all parenting. All of relationships is trust and communication. You know, you build trust, that's how you build a relationship, and you communicate your way through hard times, and when there are hard breakdowns in your relationship, and you feel one thing, and your spouse, your child, your parent feels another thing, the less you communicate, the more that it never goes away, obviously. You have to have communication. So, I don't know how much communication you had in your house, but how many times did you actually sit with your parents, probably as girls, probably a little bit more, because boys aren't very communicative, to actually sit around and talk about what do we believe in, what do we not believe in. Obviously, you have communication about other things, psychological welfare, emotional welfare. But you have to have a lot of healthy communication, and you have to hope that people accept your ideas. And remember, part of what Anglos face is, on top of the generational gap and the historical gap, is also a cultural gap. You don't speak the language, and you don't really know the music that your kids know. You don't know the Teilim, and so you have to find a way to bridge that gap. And what I said before, if someone gave me $10 million or $10 billion to change the face of, let's say, Israeli youth, or certainly Anglo-Israeli youth, I would start a birthright program. I told you this before, but I'd reverse it. Take Israeli kids of Anglos back to their parents' communities and let them, I think Israelis, let's say when they would go to South Africa, they'd be inspired by people who are dedicated to building a community. Americans don't build communities. Americans are like herdsmen. They move from community to community. None of you are davening in the shul, your grandparents davening. It's only not your great-grandparents. You have a community, and again, you don't have to build a community because it's built in. There's so many resources. It's synergetic. It's automatic. It's just there's a community. So what does it mean to build a community in America? You take your shift as the president of the shul to make announcements and to go to meetings, but you don't have to think about 20 years from now, right now, because communities are self-sustaining. In South Africa, if people aren't thinking about the community and dedicated, there won't be a community. How do you build a community block from block? I think people will be shocked. The same token, I think Israelis would be very intrigued by seeing even this shallow communal life in America, because there are people don't have these intergenerational communities where you're davening in the same shul. It's all prefab buildings you put up and you take down. The shuls don't really last. And even if they, even if communities last, they rebuild the shul so often, you barely know it's the same shul. Like when you go to England, you feel you're davening in a shul from 1870. The bricks are there from 1870. You can feel the bricks. That's a very powerful experience. Not just that we've lived in Teaneck for 50 years and we've changed the shul four times. It's a different feel. But even in Teaneck, you have a communal life that you don't have in Israel, for logistical reasons, because you don't have Sundays. But it's more existential, because your identity here is national. Your identity here is very, it's engulfed by national identity. You're part of a country, you're part of an army. Okay, you're from Farsaba, you're from Ranana, you have Suriname, from Petah Tikva, you have certain small, nuanced feelings, but the real feeling is an Israelit, v'ani shayach l'am Yisrael, v'anachnu, the papers here are all national papers, and the celebrations are, and it's a small country. A lot of it is geography, so you have to. It has to take you a while to get to another place to actually see your place as your place. Like, where do my kids live? And we live together. Okay, so my furthest kid is an hour and a half away from me. I know things run on, get on the car and I'm there. So it's just a quantitative difference whether to travel 20 minutes or an hour and a half. But like they live across the country in a part of a different culture, so. I understand a lot of Israelis get very angered when American personalities and rabbanim say you shouldn't move to Israel because you're raising your kids. It's a bigger risk to raising kids that are from. I understand the position. I disagree with the position, but I can understand it and respect it. It's definitely harder. Okay, but it's not like you're choosing to live in Teaneck or in Zanzibar. It's living in Teaneck or in Eretz Yisrael. This is a place evidently Hashem wants us to live, if you believe that Hashem is calling us back. So if there's, you can make the same claim about the economy, the same claim about the terror. So evidently there are challenges that Hashem places about settling Eretz Yisrael because it's the place of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because we're going through this. Again, it's how you see it. Is this some tragedy that all of a sudden Israeli secular culture is turning our kids off to religion and trying to empty them from religion? Or it's just the birth pains of trying to redeem our people and bring our people back and build a whole new system of religious identity upon preserving the old system. This is built in. If you see this as some, same thing with anti-Semitism, the same thing with Arab threats. If you just see it as, incidental, they hate us, I don't know why, there's anti-Semitism, they're opposed to our being here, it's a hassle, it's a pain in the neck, it's a nuisance, why should I live here? If you see it all prophetic, you know why they hate us? Because we're the chosen people. And you know why they hate us in Israel? Because it's the chosen land. And you know why they don't want us in Yerushalayim? Because it's Makom HaMikdash. And once you see it as part of the entire prophecy and the entire historical arc, then you want to be part of the solution. You don't want to avoid the problem. So people that live here and are able to see it through those historical prophetic lenses, like, I know there are issues, but someone's got to tackle them. Someone's got to solve them. As opposed to saying, it's a nuisance, I'll just catch the other plane. I'll just live in a place with less nuisance. I don't have a vested interest in eliminating nuisances in Iowa. I have a vested interest not in eliminating nuisances in Eretz Yisrael, but in rebuilding redemption. And the more nuisances and the more blocks and obstacles I remove, the closer we are to Geula. So it to a degree, it depends upon your starting point. If you see this, then you may be more willing to engage in it. If you don't see it, not just see it as a front lobe, is it something that you live with? I think a lot of people in America, and I feel the same thing when I'm in America, you're a Zionist, you believe in Eretz Yisrael, but it's not in your daily blood, it's not in your daily, because at a certain point, distance really does create a dulling of passion. And so, being that there's so many other passions, those passions rise to the top, and your passion for Eretz Yisrael is not as integrated in your personality, because you don't express it as often, things that you don't express. Like, right, one day you fall in love with your husband one day. If you separate for 20 years, you probably fall out of love, because you don't express it. So for passion to be sustained, you have to constantly express it and refresh it. To be very passionate about yourself. But if you live in New York City, and that becomes your environment and your space, so it's very, very hard. And then once it becomes less of a passion, then other factors become more passionate. So There's no fiends and criminals here. It's just a very complicated situation. But I'm more upset when people simplify nuanced issues, ignoring the multiple elements of truth that affect it. Like, that's what concerns. For someone to say it's us for doing it to Israel because it's a risk to raise your children without realizing the other narrative, that's just blind myopia. As well as the saying, I understand, with a very, very delicate historical point. And it wasn't different in 1880. There's the same debate in 1880, because basically everyone that came here turned out to be not from, for different reasons. It wasn't as much cultural, because it wasn't Israeli culture. It was just, there weren't Rabbanim here, there wasn't infrastructure, Shemitah wasn't possible, there wasn't kosher, but it was just, it was difficult. And to be honest, that's when the rabbinic support for Zionism, religious rabbinic support for Zionism, began to wane. If you go back to 1850, it's hard to find a rabbi who didn't want his disciples from Poland to go to Israel. Like, there's no reason not to. You're escaping the pogroms, you're escaping anti-Semitism, you're living in Eretz HaKodesh. Like, who in their right mind is going to try to convince one of the Talmidim not to, unless maybe it's harder to learn Torah there, but it was hard all over. One of the first waves that creates disenfranchisement with the religious establishment to Zionism is when people start going there and they lose their religion. And they lost their religion in 1880s, not because of some of the things I mentioned, but just which is really hard to survive, really hard to earn a living, really hard to... And the faith goes very, very quickly. And that's when people start to say, maybe we should stay in Europe, maybe we should just... And of course, many of those people died 50, 60 years later under Hitler, so it's hard to know. Okay? So just... I have told you so often this year, nuanced, sophisticated conversation. Sophisticated is a bit of a pejorative. You have these fancy words and highfalutin. Nuanced, informed, respectful. People aren't idiots. Yeah, I heard someone was saying before with the hangman, where it was like humanism. Was that the word I came in on?
Yeah.
Yeah. To be humanistic means you respect other people. And you respect their thoughts and you respect their ideas and you don't just simplistically reject them. Oh, they're all idiots. We have the monopoly on truth. But you realize that if people adopt approaches to life and they work and they seem to work within the halachic system, they're a little different than yours, there must be some logic to it. So it's not my logic, it's not the approach I take, but I'm not going to deny the possible validity of what they're for me. Try to understand, take people, don't take people for granted, take them with respect. They must be. And of course, the closer to the Torah world they are, the more you should respect them, because these are people, as we talked about last week, I think it was Tali's question last week, with Chazal and their fraudulent science. Yeah, but that science streamed through people who really knew Torah well. So at the very least, I want to see that permutation of false science as expressed by people who knew Torah well. Even though I'm not going to accept the scientific conclusion. But that to me is a creation that I want to see. That's a body of ideas that I want to see and understand, because these are great people. So if I look at, let's say, Haredim today, and I or whatever, arch anti-Zionist, and okay, what are they thinking? These are people who are massive, massive B'nai Torah, who commit their lives constantly to the Torah and Mitzvahs that I'm committed to, and yet they've spun this conclusion. So I'm not going to live my life by that conclusion, but I want to understand, where does that conclusion come from, without just waving a flag and saying, if you don't join B'nai Akiva, then you know, you're condemned. These are silly, silly, silly. And I told you often that Israelis, because they become ideologically sensitive earlier, they end up being very one-dimensional. There's a certain advantage to being raised in Israel. That kids, when they're 12, 13, 14, are thinking about really important matters. Kids 12, 13, 14 in America are thinking about bar mitzvah presents and shopping and sports and food and friends. And here, kids are really thinking about positions and ideology and values in the country. The downside is they're thinking about issues before their minds are supple enough to process these ideas in a subtle way. So they become very, very binary. Left, right, religious, secular, peace, not, this way, that way, I'm this one and that one. And it's very hard to climb out of that. Once you label yourself, these labels are very entrapping. You see yourself a certain way, it becomes a self-fulfilling, self-cycling experience. So be very, very careful if you raise kids in Israel to try to break them out of that. Because it's not just shallow, it's also dangerous, because a lot of the people who lose their religion in Israel is because they live, there's a higher percentage of Dati kids who go off the derech from Yishuvim, like Alon Shvut, and whatever, Ofra, whatever these places are, than there is in, let's say, Tel Aviv and Ranana. Why? Seems counterintuitive, right? Because when you build simplistic models, it's easier to blow it away, like a sandcastle. So if you live your entire life in a cloistered environment, and all you heard was one idea, and your father was a Rebbe, so basically, you got shoved ideology down your throat, and there's no other truth, and everyone, and then you walk into Tel Aviv, and you meet really nice people, ordinary people, moral people, if you're a boy, attractive people, whatever it is, and these things aren't worked into your formula for Firmkeit, all of a sudden it can become very, very destabilizing. So you have to make sure that you, building informed and nuanced and sophisticated positions is not just important because you're creating depth and authenticity, but you're also creating durability. The Eastern European Jews always mocked the Western European Jews in the late 19th century and the early 20th century because Eastern Europe had all the great yeshivas. I don't mean to insult anyone who's a Yekki who comes from German stock, but there weren't big yeshivas in Germany. All the yeshivas came from, and whatever yeshivas they had, this is many, 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 many years. I mean, basically, you didn't really have Torah centers in Germany since the 15th century. 15th century, remember the 1400s was a post-Black Plague pogroms, and it eviscerated Germany. At that point, most of the Torah world moved over to Poland. 16th century, moved easterly Poland, Russia, Hungary, Hasidus. He had a bit of a revival in the 15th, early 16th century, but they never really got their act together. Germany was never known. And then, because Germany was the seat of enlightenment and the age of science and the modern culture, so for whatever reason, it was a hard place to raise insular yeshivas, and yeshivas need to be insular to create Torah excellence. So you had these, I don't say fake yeshivas because they're real gedolim associated with it, but we would call them half yeshivas, like the famous gymnasium in Berlin that, you know, I know people that went there, and they studied secular knowledge, and they studied academics at the University of Berlin, but these guys couldn't hold a candle to what was going on in Volozhin and Slobodka, where you had people learning 14 hours a day for 10 years at a time, and they were just off the charts with their Torah knowledge, and it's impossible to compare. It's like the same thing. You try to compare the Torah excellence in the Haredi world to the Torah excellence in the Hasidic world. It's not a fair match. You're delusional. Here and then, now you could claim that the individuals who succeed in the Hasidic world, because of their breadth and because of the complexity, they supersede. But in terms of mass Torah learning, it's just a question of hours. So the amount of hours that our boys dedicate to, I told you the story of the Soloveitchik. You ever heard of Soloveitchik? Soloveitchik once went to Warsaw. He was an up-and-coming gadol that everyone had heard about, this strange gadol who also was very worldly, because remember, he made a break from his parents. Reb Chaim wasn't a Torah Madanik. His grandfather, Reb Chaim, who wore the pants in the family, like, you know, grandfather told everyone what to do. He was very, very, very staunch in his positions in general, and certainly wasn't into studying in college. I tell a story about Reb Chaim that he once went to a convention. In the late 19th century, a lot was happening in Europe. A lot of things were happening. A lot of conventions, a lot of policy decisions, Zionism and secularism, and should we be part of the same community? A lot of tumult. And Jews were starting to become politically organized. If you go back to 1820, there's no political organization. All of a sudden, people, Nevada Rabbanim, and let's get together in this group and that group, in part because they had newspapers. The newspapers are able to spread information and collect people of like-minded ideas. So Chaim went to a gathering about some important issue, I forget what, and the Or Sameach got up to speak. The Or Sameach was one of the greatest gedolim of his generation, Ben Meir Simcha of Dvinsk. He wrote the Sefer Or Sameach, so he got up to speak. So Chaim took his chair, let's say he was standing in that corner, he turned his chair like this to Rav Simcha. He faced him with the back of his chair because he wanted to demonstrate his disagreement with the Ben Amir Simcha. Okay, it's a cute end to the story. The next day, he was about to leave town. And also, what happened was the trains also help people travel. So they can actually travel. You don't have to travel by horse and buggy to these conventions far across Europe. So he's about to leave town. So he tells the shamash before they get on the train, let's go say goodbye to the Dvinsky Rav. Dvinsky Rav is the Ben Amir Simcha. So Shlomo said, what are you talking about? You didn't even look at him yesterday. So Chaim said, what do you mean? He's one of the biggest gedolim of our generation. I just disagree with his position. I needed to tell everyone that I don't agree with his position, but he's the biggest, I have to give shalom to the biggest gadol. Like, can you learn to agree with someone, disagree with someone, without defaming their character, without disrespecting them? So anyway, so what were we talking about? So we're talking Eastern Europe and Western Europe. So all the big yeshivas were in Eastern Europe, in Western Europe, and people would mock the Jews of Western Europe, and they're, you know, they're nice balabatim, but they're not really learned. And then what happened is that two things happened. First of all, after World War I, there was a total financial collapse across the globe, and Eastern Europe totally fell apart. All, remember, when you build an economy based on poverty, it's very, very, very fragile, and it can be toppled very, very easily. Not just the economy, on a personal level, right? If you live from hand to mouth, so assuming nothing goes wrong, you can make ends meet. But the second that your wife is not feeling well, and then you have a car accident, and on top, two or three things, it's easier to topple. You have healthy savings, and you put away money for long-term contingencies. So Eastern Europe was a very, very poor economy in general, and the Jews in Eastern Europe live very poorly because there were a lot of people learning. And then when there was a financial collapse in World War I, so they became very, very dependent on Western European Jewry. So remember, people didn't really collect money in America until the 1920s. Like, America was not a philanthropic place to raise money from Jews. It was only like 1925 people started to get money from America. So the, most of the fundraising was in England and Amsterdam and what else? And France and what did I forget? England, Amsterdam, France, and Germany, of course. Those are the places that people from Eastern Europe went to raise money. And the second thing that happened was that secularism broke out. I mean, it had been bubbling, but the real secularism that took Jews out of the orbit of religion happened, let's say, 1880 through 1930. And it hit a real, real climax after the First World War. And ironically, the German Jews held their own. Namely, those that were firm, because many of them had already been lost to Firmkeit, but those that were firm were less affected by the secularism. In Eastern Europe, like a fire on a prairie. I mean, it just gouged the communities because just weren't exposed to anything. And they built a very, very tight bubble, a very insular bubble, and it's much easier to burst an insular bubble. The Jews of Germany, the price they paid for their exposure was the dilution of Torah excellence, but they got a level of durability that Eastern European Jews just didn't have because they weren't inoculated because they hadn't been exposed to it. So that's also one of the, look, it's the challenge of life even if you live in Chutz Laaretz. You know, you want to build insularity to create depth and passion and commitment and focus. On the other hand, if you create too cloistered an environment, you're creating a house of cards. And you pull one card out, it's very easy for the whole thing to fall apart. So in Israel, because you're tilting already towards encounter, because we're living with all types of Jews, so it's much harder to create that calibration. Okay? So, okay, sparks of interest, yes.
Can you talk about humility? I know it seems counterintuitive and weird to talk about, but...
Yeah, it is. It is weird. that's weird to talk about. Let me collect my thoughts for a second.
No.
No, I don't want to... I can tell you the classic things, like it's not based on self-abnegation, it's not based on the myth of self-denial, it's not recognizing your talents, all that you know already, but... And your real question is, how do you build it? How do you get to it? Like, not what it is, but how do you get it? Like, I'm sure everyone in this room realizes the humility is not to be meek and not to be low self-esteem. And not to, like, I'm sure you've been through all those ABCs. Like, you need me to tell you those and to realize whom you are without giving that up. And the question is how you build it. I mean, that's already the sanctimonious part. We're going to describe humility and not so humble. Obviously, like every mitzvah, you have to see it. And the larger you see it, and the greater its expression, the easier it is to absorb. So I think Rav Lichtenstein, on anyone's card, that would be like his top two or third mitzvah. Like, it's hard to imagine a mitzvah that wasn't like that. I think people that go through struggle in life, it's easy, and process it. I once heard a rabbi friend of mine have a very interesting phrase. There was a friend of mine about a rabbi, I forget which one, but it was had something to do with a rabbi. The phrase was, I wish he would have failed earlier in life. I mean, people that have it too good and feel too invulnerable, too invincible, it becomes very hard to, want to feel fragility, want to feel, I was very touched, I read this once in Wordsworth. It's a phrase, but it's the sad still music of humanity. And there's a sadness to life when people can't get what they want and or suffering and limitations of you. Are you able to touch into people's, not just, it's easy to celebrate with people, at least feel good about people. It's harder to tap into their sadness because it reminds you of your own vulnerability. It's why it's so hard to be exposed. Remember, like very often a kid will ask me, what should I do to prepare for Eretz Yisrael? So I have a million different answers to that question, but every once in a while, if I feel the kid needs it, I'll say, I want you to, over the next couple of months, get involved in a chesed. And I'll say, like, give me an example. And I say, I mean hard chesed, not soft chesed. So what's there? So soft chesed is delivering meals for Tamchei Shabbos. Because you're not really doing chesed. You want to drive your car. And this is a good excuse to drive your car around Muncie. That's not really chesed. Hard chesed is... What?
Good call, though. I don't want to mention, but
right.
Yes.
No, you want to drive your car. You're a teenager, so chesed, right? Or a youth group leader. You don't want to make some money. You don't want to be in shul. I'm doing chesed. B'nai Akiva leader. You want to be on stage. Hard chesed is where you're facing human fragility, human suffering. Now, again, I'm not going to send a 17-year-old to be a medical clown in an oncology ward. He's 17 years old. But helping out with special needs kids is one example. Helping out with older people who need assistance. I once sent a kid to a cemetery. I don't know how. I asked him, I said, give me the three choices that some of your friends do. So A was sugar-coated, and B was waffles, and C was, some of my friends go to the cemetery every Sunday to clean graves. So do that. Go with your friends and clean. Something real. Where you face death and you face life, because if you don't face death, you're not really facing life, and people die, and there's accountability, and just... So I think that if you have exposure to difficulties, that helps. I think if you focus on real relationships rather than false public profiles, that helps. So when I come in here, I'm Rabbi Tarek. When I go home, I'm Shmageggy. I'm not really anything. Diaper the kids and take out the garbage. And my wife doesn't really care about anything I do out here. It's who I am as a person. And a lot of people run towards titles and run towards public profiles because it's a poor substitute. Because why do you think so many extramarital affairs happen in places of work? Because the dichotomy between who you are at home and who you are in your place of work is polar. At home, you're nothing, and your wife doesn't look at you, and you're always in a bad mood, and she's in a bad mood, and because she make it through, and then you walk into work, and you're a hero, and all these hotsy-totsy secretaries are waiting on you, making you coffee. Can I sharpen your pencil for you, mister, or whatever? So you're a hero at work, and at home, you're a doormat. So what would you rather be? And, of course, one thing leads to another, and sadly, that's where people go off. So I think healthy relations... Actually, I'll tell you an interesting story. Okay, maybe it's easier to say it in a story. I was once on a rabbinic panel. I think it was an SAR. It was hosted by SAR, but it wasn't an SAR event, but just to put it in SAR. So my goal on the rabbinic panels is to get away without talking. Because nobody has to be on these panels, but everyone, all the rabbis have a lot to say, so it's not really a hard goal. So I just let everyone talk, and I'm in the end. So when they tell, okay, we'll now have, each rabbi will give a 5-minute opening statement, and then we'll have questions and answers. 45 minutes later, Rabbi 2 is still on his opening statement. Because it's an occupational hazard. Rabbis love to hear themselves talk. So... always last. So this is one of those days where every rabbi was meant to give, it was 25 years ago, an opening comment. And by the time they reached me, it was the end of the end, basically 2 minutes left. So they said, sheepishly, the moderator said, okay, now we'll have a few questions. So somebody asked a question. It was really odd, because I think there were four rabbis on the panel. I literally had not said a word. I just sat there sipping my coffee. It was just fine. I daydream, thinking about articles. I'm fine. I'm really fine with it. And someone asked a question, so you'd think, read the temperature in the room, self-awareness, Rabbi 1, 2, and 3, you've done all the talking. Rabbi Targan has been like a mannequin. Let him answer the question. It's obvious. It's basic decency. So someone asked a question, one of the rabbis jumps in and gives a 20-minute answer. It was really comical. So basically, they ended the meeting. They ended the panel. Hadn't said a word. So someone in the audience... I think it was, it's definitely a rabbi. I'm thinking of one or two. I think I know who it was. Okay? He said, I have a question for Rabbi Tarek. he airmailed me a question. He said, I have a question for Rabbi Tarek. Mean face to the other rabbis. And it was such a good question. How do you avoid seeing yourself as a rock star or self-aggrandizing? He's basically criticizing these rabbanim who needed the state. It's how do you maintain, basically your question, how do you maintain your humility like that? I didn't really have 20 seconds, but this is an art when you have no time. Rav Amital taught us that. How can you say something in one sentence to bring down the house? So he said, Rabbi Tarek, how do you make sure that when you're a rabbi, you don't become self-aggrandizing and see yourself as a celebrity and a rock star and all that? I said, two words, a good marriage. I got a standing ovation. I said two words, and it's very clear. Because at home, you're a healthy marriage. It has nothing to do with who you are and what your accomplishments are. So if you invest in marriage, you invest in people that don't applaud you, and you run away from title, and it also helps you professionally, you don't get bloated. I would say those are probably the ways. Exposure to role models, exposure to weakness and fragility and sadness, and third of all, or maybe you can throw humanism in there. You love human beings, it's not about you. And then third of all, healthy marriage, where it's not about title and accomplishments. But... Yeah. I'm not, I find Tara very humbling, but you have to really, really learn a lot. I mean, I don't know. You tell me. Do you find Tara humbling?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's part of the good part of learning Tara. The more you see, the more you realize you know nothing, and the more humbled you are. Which is why the person that knows the most ideally should be the most humble, because the more you know, the more you know you don't know, right? I'm the biggest Amaritz in this room. Why? Because I'm able, more than any of you, to articulate what I don't know. Because you know so little, you don't even know what you don't know. Like if Einstein were in the room, who would be a bigger ignoramus in physics? It would be him, because he could articulate the entire world of physics. But say, I don't understand this phenomenon, I can't understand. You ask me physics, it's all Greek, I don't understand anything. So I can't even get to the stage where I can articulate my ignorance. That's how ignorant I am. So certainly with Torah, which is so infinite, the more you know you don't know. And that's why, in general, I found this to be true in general, people that really absorb Torah, I don't just mean study Torah, because there's a difference between going through a lot of Torah and absorbing Torah and personalizing Torah, tend to be humble people. And that's, you can use humility. I tell this to me all the time when they say, who should my Rabbanim be when I leave yeshiva? I say, always follow the trail of humility. Now, you have to know how to detect humility, because humility sometimes comes in different forms. It's because a rabbi demands respect, doesn't mean they're not humble. There was a mode, which Rav Lichtenstein broke, of Rabbanim demanding respect. Rav Goldwicht, who was the first Rosh Yeshiva, not the Rav Goldwicht, you know, his uncle, who was the first Rosh Yeshiva of Karen Biavne, he came from the old school. And he demanded you respect him. And there's a famous story just to demonstrate how he created this environment. He once was standing in a big base matters, I don't know how many people were there, a couple hundred boys, and he asked for a cup of water. Which, by the way, right off there, Rav Aaron, in a million years would never ask for a cup of water from a boy. Like, it was just so out of his wheelhouse to ask any boy to do something for him. But it's totally normal to expect you're giving a share. So the boy brought a pitcher and a cup, put it down, and went back to his seat. Rav Goldwicht waited for the boy to sit down. Then he said, now come back up and pour it for me. Now you can roll your eyes and say, oh, that's so arrogant. I said, no, it wasn't about him. I knew him. He felt that he was an example of Torah, and by honoring him, you're honoring Torah. And this is a way to build. Otherwise, how do you honor Torah? Where's Hashem? Where's Torah? If I honor the Talmud Chacham, then I'm having a real fit. Now, you could argue its merits or demerits, but there are certain merits. And in our world, there are. Rav Aaron's revolution was to make everything less formal, and dress in a check shirt, and not hold yourself at a distance. But you pay a really heavy price. You pay a really heavy price. And I don't want to go through it now, but there's something to be said about figureheads and about looking up to people and being inspired by people who are at a distance from you. And sometimes, even if that distance isn't natural because of their talent level, but the distance is created and institutional and functional, there's something to be said. Oh, and the Hasidic world, to a degree, functions that. Can I tell you that merit for merit, pound for pound, every Hasidic Rebbe is such a great Talmud Chacham? No, they fill positions, they fill profiles, and that profile creates experience, which is very true and very necessary. We're intoxicated, we're drunk with meritocracy. You know, if you're not better than the other person, you don't deserve any title. But because of that, we suffer a leveling effect. We don't create any great people. Same thing with intellectual honesty. In the art scroll world, they create honorific books, and they turn Gedolim into super angelic people. And you know, because of our distaste for intellectual dishonesty, we bring everyone down. We ground everyone because everyone is a complex person. Everyone has strengths, and we almost have an aversion to creating inflated personalities. But that comes back to bite us because, well, there's no figureheads that we aspire to be. Then who do we honor? Who do we get excited by? Is there anyone that you'd be excited if they came into the room? Oh my goodness, this is a gadol. So there's merits and demerits, and like I said before, you have to. Have your eyes open and be intellectually honest and be honest with yourself and be respectful of others. And okay, but this is not my derech. Our derech is, for all of its demerits and disadvantages, this is how we're going to roll. This is how we're going to perform. So I don't know what I was saying before, but whatever I was saying, right? So I think if you learn a lot of Torah, hopefully, because remember, just because someone knows a lot of Torah doesn't mean that it's sunk into the deeper levels of their personality, because it could be depth blockers. It could be certain barriers of ego and self that prevent. The less barriers there are, the more it's open and it flows down to your core. But if it's about you, so all it takes is a really strong brain to know a lot of Torah. It's just because a person knows a lot of Torah doesn't mean they're humble. It doesn't mean they know a lot of Torah. They just have processed a lot of Torah. So if you, in general, I mean, I'm just trying to think, people that I found to really know Torah at its core tend to be humble. Sometimes the humility is expressed in different ways, and you can't expect that the expressions of humility will be the same. Okay. Oops. We don't have time for Shia, but one more question. I have time for us to go to a wedding tonight. If you have, if not, yes.
So to Ayla's question a little bit, if you were to see your kid a little bit showing disinterest and stuff, showing how do you save it? Push away.
Yeah, Baruch Hashem, I never had that challenge. Let me start from the other way. My kids knew. It was very clear to me, and they poke fun of me, but it was very clear. I'm not so sure it's clear in every household that if they became secular and not religious, I would die. I mean, it would be the end of my life. I just couldn't handle it. But if they became Haredi, I'd be the happiest person around. And I'm not sure that message is sufficiently conveyed. In some cases, sometimes it's the opposite. I don't know enough, but I'm sure in some families, there may be such a horror directed towards Haredim that because we dress similarly and we share a culture with non-Haredim, that there may be implicit message, you know what, secular is not the end of it. God forbid. I think it's just important. And Rav Aaron used once the bench analogy. If you're sitting on a park bench and Haredi's on one side and the secular is on the other, who do you feel closer to? So the Rav Kook answer is to both, because it's all on Israel. But the existential answer, not the metaphysical answer, is obvious. Shabbos is Shabbos, and halacha is halacha, and mikvah, kashrus is kashrus, everything. Of course you sit next to the Haredi. You have a few important differences, but just because you dress like someone, and because it's common culture, and because you go to university to them. So I think that has to be very, very clear, again, without defaming and dismissing and disparaging secular Jews, and it's not so easy. The easiest way to make things clear to 10-year-olds is through disparagement. They're terrible, we're great, but you have to obviously avoid that because that's a larger issue. I will tell you this. One of the things I received from Rav Amital was, and it's not really your question because I didn't really have that concern, but Rav Amital told me once that he went to a bris and the name of a family member, Haredi family member, it's actually a cute story. I think I told you the story once. And they named the baby Tuvia. And in the post-bris speeches by the parents, by the grandparents, everyone was saying, Tuvia Eloi, Tuvia Eloi. Eloi means a genius. So Amital said, did I miss something? I thought his name was Tuvia. And everyone said, no, we want him to get used to hearing himself called an Eloi as soon as possible. He should be an Eloi. You can imagine Rav Amital went ballistic. This is not something he was comfortable with. And he basically got up and said, just be a healthy, normal Oved Hashem who's happy. Of course, you have more ambition, follow your ambition. But in that very, very delicate space between ambition, listen carefully, and emotional well-being, and sometimes those are at loggerheads, Rav Amital always gave us and me the message you should prioritize, especially in today's world of family dysfunction and emotional stress, should always, always, always stress emotional well-being and self-esteem, even at the cost of a little bit more religious output. And I know a lot of people would not agree with that, but I follow that. And there were points in my relationship with my kids that I wanted them to do more. I was frustrated they weren't doing more. Again, they weren't leaving religion, but I was frustrated that they couldn't do more. But I deemed that their mental health required, their emotional health required just a softer landing and a softer space without that much religious pressure. But it doesn't mean you should pull back religious pressure. I think a lot of people today are afraid to exercise religious muscles because of burnout. And to quote Neil Young, who was a 70s singer, I don't know if you even know what I'm talking about, but you can Spotify him. Better to burn out than to fade away. That's one of his phrases. But modern Orthodox people are so afraid of burnout they never begin to burn. So we're so afraid of burnout. No one in this room is in danger of burnout. You've all had broad backgrounds, trips, camps, tours, fun, Sharia. Burnout means you put someone in a room like John Stuart Mill's, who taught his brother Latin at the age of 6, and by 7 he had a nervous breakdown. That's burnout. You're in a small little room in England, you never see the light of day, all you do is eat black bread and soup, and you learn Latin all day. Again, unless you have a psychological thing pressuring you, but most of you normal, level-headed people, oh my goodness, I can't let my son come back, I bet he's going to burn out. Please, just stop with the platitudes. Now, you don't want to come back, it's for whatever. Emotionally, it's fine, but it's not going to burn out. No one's burning out. No one's going anywhere. No one's going to lose this. Can't come back and my son's skills will atrophy He won't be able to handle college. I want to say, like, let me tell you something, okay? Your son could go to Harvard and Yale at the same time. He'll use less intellectual horsepower than he has to put forth on his average day in course, trust me. Yeah. Don't worry. We got that covered, okay? The sugars that I'm teaching him, I know the people in Harvard and Yale, with all due respect, yeah, they're nice people, they give good lectures, but it's not like your son's going to be overwhelmed intellectually. Just say it. You want your son home. I'm fine. You're the mother. You have to have the son home. But don't spin narratives that, you know, again, don't. You lose your credibility. When the train goes off the rails and you start spinning narratives that aren't true, people see right through them, you lose credibility. Just speak the truth. I miss my son. I want him home. Whatever. Okay, that's great. You're the mother. Last time I checked, you're the parents. I'm not. You make that call. But anyway, so Rav Amital taught me that. So it's actually a cute story. The Shani still teaches it once, right? So her older son, his bar mitzvah, he now lives in Ephrat. He's a doctor. He's a nice, healthy person. But at his bar mitzvah, so her side of the family went in that direction. You have to do this. You have to do that. You have to finish Shas four times. You have to climb Har Sinai. You have to be a Malach. If that's and the other. And I was the last one to speak, and I'm uncle. I'm not a rabbi. I'm an uncle. So I got up and I said, his name is Ashi. I said, Ashi, you know. Anyway, the speaker before me said, and now that you're a bar mitzvah, no more chocolates. That was like the final line. No more chocolates for you because you're a big man already. So I got up basically said, Ashi, keep eating chocolate. So like he went to Gush. He was in the Hasdeh program at Gush. Every time he passed me, like he held up a chocolate bar. It's like a little joke. And he's still having chocolates. So I had his offer if I gave the same speech, and I called his wife up and I gave her a chocolate bar. And I said, no, you've eaten chocolate. I'm finished. I made sure that he ate chocolates for the year's team bar mitzvah. So just... That's an important decision in today's world, but don't mistake that decision with not applying religious pressure. I think a lot of people are so concerned with their religious well-being and emotional well-being. God forbid, you know, we're trying to pad our kids' lives, and God forbid they should fall. And, you know, snowplower mothers and helicopter mothers, I don't know exactly the difference between, you know, snowplows, and you pave everything, and helicopter means you hover, and upholstery mothers, and everything is padded. So you've got upholstery and helicopter and snowplows, and failing is important. Struggle is important, right? And be happy when people meet adversity, because you build muscles and you build coping capabilities. And the really successful people in life are the people that go through struggle and that face struggle. And, you know, this is the anti-struggle tool, because anytime you have a problem, you have a solution. Mommy and daddy are right there to solve it for you. So, like, face struggle and find resourcefulness, and let people fail. Okay, see you next week. We'll get back to these sources. I'm leaving them here on this table. Okay, we are going to read a source next week. Okay, next week is this year. Okay.
Is next week our last class?
I'm here the whole